just what I say when I pray. Speak in faith, and when I'm done, I'll say amen. Oh.
Doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. To hear the whistle blow, she's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
WAFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This is Sunday, January the 6th. We are almost one full week into 2019. This is the Prairie Monk Program, WAFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, and seasons, greetings, and what has been going on, what the past year brought us, and what the current year hopefully will bring.
Well, Happy New Year to you all. I had a little problem right now. My computer printer sprayed out all my script, so I am a little confused. That's all right. We get things done. This week we had a meteor shower, and that was fun. Ted Talontis from Western Illinois wrote in to explain what it was about. And so I went out into the boondocks And I saw one streak, but that was it. It was not easy to see because it was low on the skyline, and I didn't go too far. I had a disadvantage of light from Champaign, from St. Joe, and Rantoul. Champaign Forest Preserve has just been given an award for having a designated light dark dark spot. It's in Kerr Township, near to Penfield, north of Penfield, and there's the Vermilion River comes through there from Ford County, so there's not a lot of buildings right there, and there's a lot of open space. And but when you get out there into the boondocks, there's a really beautiful sky. It was an open night, no clouds. So I enjoyed the sky itself. I grew up with open skies in boondocks in Australia, and you could see the Southern Cross and other formlands really nicely. And then every once in a while, when there was a action, a sunspot action, there was an aurora australis, which is counterpart to an aurora borealis in the northern hemisphere, where sunspot activity interacts with the magnetic fields of the Earth and creates these rather beautiful curtains. And the curtains are different depending on the interaction between electrons and protons. And it's not an awfully understood procedure, but it is to do with that sort of interaction, which in the process of changing from one electronic format to another produces light of different intensities and different beauties. And so I've been privileged to grow up with that. It's near at the poles, but it comes down into the in Borealis, it comes down into the more middle latitudes, just very occasionally. And in Australia, it comes up to the middle latitudes too. When I came back, I started. It's always been a campaign of mine to have lighting that doesn't go up into the sky. And I came back and I started to photograph lights that were pointed down. And so the light is where you want it. It's not up there in the sky creating light pollution. In World War II, you had recognition of this because the cities, especially, could be picked up by Japanese flight units and detected. So you had to have your houses with curtains. You were encouraged not to have a lot of light. You drove cars that had a tiny little slit in them and a hood on top so that the light would not be shining up. So you can do this if you want to, but right across from us now is a set of bar lights, and most of their light is going everywhere, including up in the air, where it's not useful for anyone. So that's my small rant on light pollution. It has a lot to do with people who want to go out to Homer Lake and watch some of these things. Let me just give David a set of notes. I wanted to say something about sugar. After Christmas, there was a lot of sale of sugary items like chocolate milk. And I was tempted to buy it. It's economic. But when I tasted it, it was dramatically loaded with sugar. And that's not good for our health. And I wonder how we get to have agencies that are commodity users or supermarkets to at least drop the sugar content just a little bit each year. It has to do with the economy. Sugar is popular. People have gotten used to it because sugar also helps to preserve things by exosmosis. If you put a sugar solution outside a bacterium, it can attract the water out of the bacterium, and so you can send butter around the world or things like that. So sugar and salt have that advantage, and we've gotten used to it, but somehow somebody should write letters to food people and beg them to at least drop the amount of sugar a little bit. It's too bad that often flavors are taken over by sugar, and it can kill. Too much sugar can kill and increase the amount of diabetes and other diseases. So we need to look at sugar. So that's my second rant. The detention pond has been up where we put our little pocket prairie. And it rained for about the best part of a week. And it rose up and it's going down now. The prairie grew up in swampland, so it can handle a little bit of that, but not to the extent of being waterlogged. So we had visitors and took them over to that. Now, season's greetings. We were very pleased. I have to congratulate David and Brett Pugh for working on this in the background to the extent that we could get a 15-page electronic report out. It wasn't a fundraiser. It was just a friendly note of recent activities, not even the whole of what we do. It involved working with a fairly extensive contact list. It meant writing a note to various people. I have friends in the Art Institute where I used to be part of a team of three of us that used to teach an artist in the landscape course for a long time. I wrote to the Department of Transportation because I'm interested in 10 miles of retired Route 45 from Rantoul to Paxton. So different people were getting different messages, but it had a background of Brett Pugh working on the hardware side of things. Old Mac computers have died, and we have to go to a new format. We can't even use the old format very much because when it's at a certain stage, the people who administer programs will not service them if you're not up to date. So we're more up to date with hardware and with software. But both David and Brett work on both of those things. And it means that I, as the writer of some of this material, very dependent on just the little things that make it work. it's amazing. So I feel very pleased with having, at least after several years of trying, gotten a newsletter out, and reasonably in the seasonal time. One other thing was rather interesting. We picked pictures that were reasonably transmittable to color, from color to black and white. So David has at the moment a colored copy, which costs 75 cents a page, but at the black and white level, it costs 15 cents a page. And so this goes to, I think we had well over 100 letters go out, and the response has been rather fantastic. Business people don't come back in this week often, so we don't expect answers from them. But often, and we don't expect any answer at all, but it gives people an idea of what we do, and it recognizes that their involvement in this sort of thing, which is quite serious. The number of people who helped us move the Pocket Prairie, for instance, is quite serious. We have a new buyer, and we have to respect that, and the fact that it's also keeping the character of Market Street intact. And it seems like the News Gazette buildings that have been sold will be restored rather than being replaced with apartment buildings. So we're pleased about that. The Idea Store has moved from Champagne to the Banner Lincoln Square Mall, and doing very well. And it's augmented a little with the indoor market. And there are people bringing volunteer donations of materials that often they have had for a lifetime. They've had an interest in cards or rubber stamps or clothing or little pieces of magnets or glasses, spectacles, or, and you name it. And people come in and buy, and that the funds go to the school districts. So I'm rather pleased with that. There is another secondhand store nearby that also is doing well, and we wish Urbana success with Lincoln Square, because it hasn't, the hotel that goes with it hasn't had the success it was hoped for. But I am always pleased to be there and to be interacting with people and listening to their stories and telling some of my own. The Urbana Business Association runs the indoor market, and they've not been quite sure of times and how often. So I was a vendor before Christmas. After Christmas, I went down to as a buyer at the first day after, in between Christmas and New Year, there wasn't a mall. And I wasn't the only one. There were other people arriving with their dilly bags, ready to buy. And it was, so somehow, if you work on this sort of organization, you need to have some sort of format. This last Saturday, I went there between 12 and 1 o'clock, and the mall had been in action. But for some reason, they decided to stop it at 12 o'clock. so once again, I was there was people who came in expecting a certain time. So we talk back and forth. This is part of organization, is to try and figure out how to work with people to get some sort of unanimity. The same things apply to meetings. There are some meetings that meet in different locations, and it's well known that they do that, so that's the format. But there are some meetings that just meet in different places, and that's tremendously frustrating to people who are intermittent visitors to a meeting. They have it in their heads that it's going to be in one place, and then they get there, and it's not there. So regularity is important. WEFT has had their meeting at the city building, and it's been there fairly regularly for quite a while. They've had to be in other places too. Packer is the same way. Packer actually meets in different buildings because the buildings are important. Mm-hmm. Somehow those sort of meeting places are important as establishments, and the time is important too. I thought I'd add a few. Oh, before we leave the greetings that we sent out, I would say I had quite a bit of help from the Havana Free Library to produce prototype materials that may not necessarily be the ones you send out, but maybe the ones that help to format little items like page numbers, if you want to have a page number. And this was our first link. This is, we've had other links about the Pocket Prairie, but this was our first formal link. And David, you might say something about links so that people understand what they are, because for neophytes, they're not always understood.
A long time ago, I had a class at the university where one of our assignments was to create a web page, and it was mostly static. I actually put a picture of Porky Pig on mine, as I remember, and mostly it was just putting words on the page. That's fine. There's nothing interactive about that. But the language that you use, the programming language basically that you use to create a web page, allows for what Dave is calling links, which means you can have words on the screen. And if people click on the words, they get taken to something. So that the point to this page was actually we were supposed to go online, find things about square dancing in Chicago and whatever, and then you had to give the professor a page that showed, click here to go to some square dancing group in Chicago. So that's the way you actually start to make web pages interactive. It would be really boring. People like to create blogs. Blogs can be interesting if the person writing them is interesting enough. But if it's just a bunch of words, you have to really be interested to sit and just scroll through and maybe see the occasional picture and leave it at that. It's nice if they can say, oh, and if you want even more information than I have room for in my blog, click here, and then you've got a whole other thing. So it's a way to make the internet more diverse. You can be concise on one page, but people can go and dig as deep down, can go as far down the rabbit hole as they want to by following links. So I think what Dave is saying is that he put together links so that he could give people the brief version. I remember he did this. He sent out more kind of a two-page season's greetings, and then in his email that he sent out saying, thank you for being out there. I really like the way this is worded. Thanks for being interested in interesting people who have helped us to preserve rails, trails, and greenways in East Central Illinois. That was on the two-page version. And then he said, P.S., would you like 15 more pages? Just click here. And that would take you to this full-blown version that Dave has handed to me with lots of pictures that I recognize, because if you go online to watch the video version of this on YouTube, you have seen some of these maps and the pictures that Dave has taken over the years to help explain what it is that you just hear on the radio.
The interesting thing is that when you send a link to someone, they can send that link to other people. I was not necessarily listing, say, 100 people on one page and sending it as a formal note. I was writing notes to each person. But people who have received this link have already channeled it on to a list or to persons that they know would be interested. And that's very helpful. And you have to know that if we're going to do this by snail mail, it's going to be expensive. I would suspect that I'd have to pay best part of $2 a hard copy to send to people who don't have a computer. And quite a few of our supporters, not necessarily computer literate. They may do emails, but they don't necessarily have a lot of expertise in handling computers. So hard copies are helpful, and they're also necessary for archiving and recording so that people know what is there. And sometimes you're dealing with a prototype, so another group might do something and pick up some ideas from this sort of thing. We were talking to Dennis Roberts last week about Boneyard, and they're having to think about this sort of information to people, whether you can have it at the library, whether it has to go out electronically, whether it goes to committees. Is there a formal not-for-profit organization? Is there a 501c3, which is a tax exemption for people who want to donate? So I was pleased with this sort of achievement and the number of friends and relatives that were involved and obviously wrote back, and often with ideas. Ted Talontes is a person that we've known for a long time. He's in Western Illinois. He wrote back with information about the media shower. And I thought I might go at this time of the year. I have legs in two countries. I grew up in Australia, and I've spent a lot of time in the U.S. And so this is part of my home. But Australia is also part of my home. And I think about my home people at this time of the year, and my brother and my sister and my parents. And so my involvement here has taken me away from close proximity from a family. And we can do Facebook or other forms of photography where we see each other in our respective computer displays. That has helped a lot, but you still think of these things. One of the things I thought about was at this time of the year in Australia, it's hot. It may be up to 100 degrees, and some places it has been higher than that. Just because it's probably associated with global warming. But it's hot, and you tend to do things that you would do outside in the summertime. And one of the things we would do was look at the chicken run. You know, the Australians called chicken runs fowl runs, F-O-W-L, fowls. And we needed some separate units for hens that were perhaps 2 years old and laying regularly, and hens that were broody and would give rise to chickens. They would hatch eggs, perhaps a dozen eggs, and they would look after these chickens into their adulthood. So you need some different facilities. So we had next door to us, we were in a very rural setting, we had a sclerophyll forest. A sclerophyll forest is a forest that's reasonably open. It, in this case, it's eucalypts, tall eucalypts, but it has an understory and the trees are sort of dispersed, and some of them are very large. One day, it was about this time of the year, my father said, let's build a new chicken house, or fowl house, as the Australians would call it. And we go out, we look for small, straight saplings. And we'd look for saplings that were perhaps more numerous in one place than another, so we didn't necessarily take out essential trees. It might be that the sapling was 6 inches across or 5 inches across. And so I thought I'd tell you about the whole process and some of the things that we do with working with woodwork. Things have changed a lot. Working with wood has been mechanized a lot. But when you grow up in an era that was still in the horse era, being replaced by mechanical trucks with hard tires, with milking machines coming in for the first time, with small sawmills, there were still the people who were doing things in a traditional way because they either didn't have the money to go to a sawmill and buy planks of wood, or they were, it was convenient and economic to build your own. And so often the techniques that are used are those that have been used for centuries. But it's a sort of time when father and son, two sons, get together and build a small facility for perhaps 100 chickens. So we select a tree, and the first thing there is to know how to harvest it. You want it to fall in a direction so that it doesn't break down a whole bunch of other trees. There's a direction. You need to take a cut in the lower part of the tree that faces the direction you want it, the tree to fall in. And then you go to the other side and you make a higher cut so that the tree will fall in that direction. So there's just a little bit of technology that is important. Then you have to strip the bark off the tree. You have a sledgehammer, and it's easy to remove the bark from a fresh tree. You need to do that to make sure that you have good wood, with not too many knots in it. So you might even take that tree and allow it to season for a year. You may stack it leaning up against the fence for a while so it dries out. Or you can use it as a green material. If you use it as green material, you have to know that it's going to shrink. So if you put clapboards up on, or weatherboards up on the edge, you can nail them in, but you always leave the nailed out about a half an inch so that when the board shrinks, you can come back, take the board out, and fasten it with knowledge of the shrinking will be ceased. The next step is to take that tree, sort out a length, and we were putting the trees into the ground. The early barns were like this. You just put your tree into the ground. And then you're looking for cross beams and you're looking for clapboards. There's various tools you need. You need a saw, and you need an axe that's a very sharp axe. a dangerous axe if you're not very careful. You must make sure that you don't have any vines behind your head or wherever you're going to lift that axe up and bring it down. You need space to work in. And you need chains to move that tree if it's a heavy one. You might have a horse to do the dragging. Wrap the chain around the end of the log and attach the horse through swingle bars to that chain and move it. Mostly that what we were working with, we could pick up ourselves. It's amazing if you have two or three people on a fairly heavy log and you all lift at the one time, it gets done. You can even have a song that goes with it so that you all lift at a certain time. That's how you lift railroad lines, is to lift 33 feet a stick of steel railroad, and you all have little clamps and lift it up, and there's a foreman, and the foreman usually knows the songs, and you lift, and if you want to move 2 inches or 5 inches or half an inch, then there are different songs for different movements. we weren't that organized. We were relaxed. My father was interested in, he was a school teacher, and this area where the trees were was good for picnics. It had some underground grass, lady grass, and kind of a useless grass, but and very tough. So it's not the sort of grass that cattle would graze on. And not a lot of understory, but there were trees that were fallen. And some of them were quite large. So Father, while he was harvesting for a tree for a fowl house, would also look at a down tree and take portions where he could make a flat spot for a picnic lunch plate or a seat. So he would modify the down tree so it could be used. And we would have, for years, we had picnics at that site with that particular tree. We also had to share with the animals. Some of the animals were big lizards called goannas, and they were near our poultry yard, and part of the reason for doing the poultry work was to make sure that goannas didn't help themselves to eggs. They knew where the hens laid their eggs, and I've watched a goanna very neatly take an egg and break it open, and with a kind of forky tongue to lick the contents out of the egg. So in the long run, we wanted to discourage these 4-foot-long creatures that would help themselves to some of our food. So you had a wire netting surrounding the fowl yard. You also had hawks and oxibiters that were going to take chickens especially. So sometimes you not only had to have a wire fence, a netting fence around your yard, but you had to have a fence over the top so that hawks just didn't help themselves either. There were also foxes and various creatures that had been invaded on by the citizens that were settling. So the trees that they used, the food they used, was driving them to work with the foods that the incoming settlers had brought. It might be a calf if it was a fox, so we're still looking at the ecology here, even though we're modifying it. Go a little further with this wood stunt. We may put some pictures up if we can find the old agricultural almanacs would tell you these sorts of things, so it's no secret. But it was fun to be able to do this sort of work, and also to be a school teacher, to also grow vegetables, to also have a house that was on the side of a hill so that the front of the house could be a carpentry shop. And so you go back to early settlers when they were putting up barns. And the same thing here, except in the U.S., especially in places like Champaign County, you didn't have any trees, so you had to import them. You had to import yellow pine, especially from, say, Wisconsin or Texas. But we had our timber. It was eucalypt. It was not the world's greatest timber, but if you were doing a barn, you had to think about not only having a round pole to work with, but you had to make a square pole so that you could make joints and build a new construction. That meant you had to have square beams. Sometimes in small elevators around here, the beams may be 17 inches by 17 inches. That, you have to know, has to come from a very large tree. In order to saw those, these days you would go to a mill. You would take a log that was 3 feet in diameter, and the mill would deal with it. But in the past, when you didn't have that facility, you dug a hole that was about 6 feet deep, and enough for a man to stand in. And it was probably about 6 feet wide and the length of the beam. So if you had to use a 10-foot beam, you would have probably an 8-foot long hole. The whole point of this would be to have a cross-cut saw. A saw that had handles at both ends. So one man would be in the hole and one man would be above. And you would already have taken a string, and you would make a mark on your tree trunk that would keep you straight. And usually you dip this in flour or something, so that if you had the string taut at either end, you pinged it, and you then left a mark on the bark to tell you where to saw. But the saw would probably be sharpened by a saw sharpener. Each little sprig in the saw would be set at a certain angle. So a good saw would also saw straight, and it would saw well, and it would rake the sawdust out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you would add a little oil to make sure that the blade would move freely. But the action of the people on either end would be important. So one pulls and then the other one pulls. You don't end up pushing. So you would create a flat surface on one side, and then you do the same for the other three sides. And so now you have a beam. And that's very convenient. If it's rough and tough, you might want to work on that beam, or even create it in the first place by taking an axe and cutting into the beam every 6 inches for the whole length of the beam. And that would be with an axe that was very sharp, and you're basically wanting to make a flat surface. And you can do that I then coming in with a broad axe. A broad axe is probably about 10 and 12 inches in width. It's like a big old medieval axe. And it can be a left-handed axe or a right-handed axe. The main thing is that you should not bark your knuckles when you go to chop the edge that's already marked with axe marks. And if you look at an old barn here or in other countries, you will see those sorts of marks where there has been a cut in with a regular axe and a carving with a broad axe. Then the next step is to take that log and take an adze. An adze is like a small hoe, very heavy, very strong, and with a blade that is annealed in the sense that it's hardened, but you'd also have a stone to sharpen it on. And then you would stand with your legs across the beam, no longer over the hole. You would be out on a flat land. And you would then carve that surface down. That's fairly important, especially if you're going to have a beam in any contact with the weather. And one of the advantages of doing this handwork is that you can modify your work to match the grain. So if this tree has a little curl in it, you can make the beam a curly beam, but it's strong because you've taken the wood and not gone cross it. It's not going to have if you sawed that beam straight, you would make access for water and rot. So these tools were helpful to your work. If you had a larger log, you would need to cut it down. So you would have a wedge, and the wedge is a way of taking a sledgehammer and creating a crack so that you gradually bust the log in two and three and four places. So that this whole length, you would have the length sawn with probably a double-ended saw. And so now you have lengths about the length that you want for your beam. And then is when you start to work with a broad axe and or regular axe, and then a broad axe and an adze. And those workmen had those skills, and they knew how to keep according to the grain. If you go to an old railroad line, you'll see curly ties. That's when in the era of this, what I'm talking about, the tie would be designed to meet the grain. And those curly ties are often sitting around because they're very hard to load. You can't put nine ties together and put a bundle, a string around them and sell them at the local hardware store. They don't stack well, but they are around because they have that grain has been admired and used, and the technique was enough to allow people to get a feeling for the grain. You also had to select your trees. You had to if you want to have good coachwood for the interior of trains, you have to take a tree which was named coachwood tree. And so there's a density. Here you have an Osage orange tree which is tremendously dense. And thinking of that, let's look over to firewood. We grew up without electricity and without running water and without gas. So you were very dependent on stoves. And the stoves would be designed so that you could start them with kindling wood, but then if you were baking certain things, you're usually the housewife did the baking, and she would know whether to use turpentine or oak or...
Turpentine?
Well, turpentine, probably named because it had turpentine in its background.
That would have pretty strong flavors, wouldn't it?
Well, you're using it to burn. Mm-hmm. So you have a fire, and it's giving you a certain type of heat. And you had a stove that was adjacent to the firebox, and you had a way of moving the air around by convection, so that you, if you were baking scones, you had a different need for heat than if you were baking a baked dinner with a chicken and sweet potatoes and pumpkins and whatever. So your housewife would ask you to please bring some turpentine wood or some dense wood if that was the way of controlling the temperature. Early on, if you had cleared the land, there were usually trees left. They were stately trees, maybe fig trees or huge trees. They didn't always last because you were taking away their friends and relatives, and the way these trees survived was to have a friend and relative. And so they were not deep-rooted always. They were shallow-rooted. And sometimes they would die, and the birds would be there. And they, too, have been disturbed by the settlement, and they, too, would need to find the mice and other creatures, and this would be a platform for their viewing, and they have very good eyesight, and they can detect movement and smell. Other trees were sort of dead and dying, and they'd fall over, and we would go with a long saw, usually with person on either end, and we'd saw the log in 2 foot length so that they would be ready to put into a fire for baking. You may want to know that tree has been matured and dead for some time, because if it was a green tree, you were going to produce a whole lot of smoke with green wood. Sometimes we had to transport the wood to our wood pile. It might be an eighth of a mile away or something like that. So then we would not cut it in 2 foot lengths. We would cut it in 10 foot lengths. And we as children would take a chain and tie it around the front of that log. It would be wedged so that it made into strips, almost like Abe Lincoln's fence. What would you call them? And not only the posts, but the pieces between each post. So we would take that sort of sized piece of log and tie a chain around it and then run down the hill to deliver that to the wood pile. A little more sophisticated, you had a saw with an engine on the end of it. Not two people, but it was would oscillate back and forth. And I can remember growing up with that particular saw that we would take to a tree. We'd usually have someone who knew how to work it. And I can remember the sound. And when it came to a hard piece of wood, it would be working harder. And so that particular had a name, and I'm just forgetting what the name for it was. but it was a horizontal saw, and the engine was on wheels. And the next step up was to take a circular saw, and that circular saw would do the job. And more recently, you have chainsaws, and you use different technology. But people who use wood still have to break that wood into units that are enough to work with and have a store of firewood just outside your back door so that your mother could pick up the wood that she needed and cook the dinner. We also had no washing machine, so we also had to have wood for a copper of water. That copper of water would be used for food preparation. It was clean water. It was used also to boil your clothes. We had wash tubs and wringers. A lot of hand operations. We had a bath, but we would take that hot water, and that would be our bath water. So the youngest person of the family would go in first, and then the next, and then the next, and then mother, and then father. So you'd use your water carefully, because you may have 80 inches of rainfall in a monsoonal time, but you would also have drought. And so we had 2,000 gallon tanks outside the back door, and it would collect water from the monsoonal time and from the runoff of a roof. You had to look after that water. You didn't waste it. You didn't also waste the overnight urinations. We would have an outdoor toilet, but overnight you had urines that would be used to fertilize the peas we ate later. So we had orchard trees, and when you filled up your toilet, your pit toilet, you then planted on top of that a tree. And I can remember grapefruit that were huge and wonderful. I can remember that when the Governor General came by at one time, it was a ceremonial thing, and my father lined up all the school kids, and so this was an unexpected stop that he was given.
1 minute.
Oh, wow.
I was just going to interject here. Putting a tree on top of where the pit toilet had been, there's this expression in growing grapes, terroir. Supposedly the land that you put your grapevines on top of influences aspects of the grapes.
Oh, absolutely.
I wonder what your grapefruit, never mind. But anyway, yeah, 45 seconds.
Oh, I didn't put my cell phone out to see what time it was. So,
45 seconds.
I think we have to close out here. This is... we appreciate your listening here, and I appreciate being able to reminisce about wood and what you do with wood. My father was a carpenter, so a lot of his stuff was carpentered from a carpenter shop under the house. So, okay, this is Dave Mount, your Prairie Mount, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And as I said before, season's greetings from Heartland Pathways, with thanks for being interested in interesting people who have helped us to preserve rails, trails, and greenways in East Central Illinois. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It's now noon. That means it's time for Shruti, Music of India. Here on WEFT, we are community radio for East Central Illinois.